Thanks so much for being with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk a bit about bird migration with you on the show today. It's well underway. Half of Wisconsin's birds winter in tropical habitats, and research shows that migration is when 60 to 70% of annual bird mortality happens. And I checked BirdCast migration dashboard before coming on the show, and there were estimated 399,000 birds passed through Wisconsin last night. Almost 400,000 birds. And, of course, that's with all the other ones that are still here. We're going to talk about the Wisconsin DNR's effort to preserve stopover points for migratory birds on the show now. Our guest is Craig Thompson. He's been with us a while back. He's the Chief of Program Integration in the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation at our Wisconsin DNR. He heads or leads the DNR's bird conservation efforts. And so as we talk with Craig, I hope you'll join in. Questions about the journey Wisconsin birds take each spring and fall? Other questions? Give a call at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Craig Thompson, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. I'm delighted to be here this morning.
Understand that North America has lost more than 3 billion birds since 1970. Is that a correct number, and why?
Yeah, that is a correct number. And so what we're seeing are precipitous declines, again, across virtually all groups of birds in North America. And the primary reason for those losses since 1970, the number one reason is habitat loss, Larry. So, you know, no habitat, no birds. It's a really straightforward equation. There are a number of other factors that are conspiring to drive bird numbers down. Changing climate, window collisions with tall towers, outdoor cats, and so on. But nothing, those all pale in comparison to the bird losses associated just simply with habitat change, not only here in Wisconsin and across North America, but as you had mentioned earlier, fully 50% of our birds spend the winter in Central and South America, and habitat loss is rampant down there. And those birds are entirely dependent on tropical habitats for survival. So what we now know is that we have to work at both ends of these birds' hemispheric ranges conservation-wide in order to preserve them.
And so what is it about migratory birds? 60 to 70% of the birds lost are migratory.
Yeah, so migration is the most hazardous period of time in a bird's annual cycle. And what happens is, you know, those birds are on the move. So when a bird is set up and it's breeding, it's familiar with its territory, it knows where to go. It, you know, knows when to anticipate the hawks more often than not, the bird-eating hawks, where to hide, where to find water, where to find food. But when they're undertaking these migratory journeys, it's new turf. And so they're encountering all manner of hazards as they move across the Western Hemisphere. Cars, radio towers, windows, and the whole ball of wax. And so in addition to inclement weather. And so it's hard for birds to know exactly what to do when they encounter these kinds of hazards during migration. And on top of that, Larry, finding suitable habitat to refuel is a really big deal. So if you're moving along and you're moving, let's say, at 300, 400 miles a day, you're flying all night long, which these passerines do, and you land in the morning, you need to re-tank immediately. So what birds want to do is feed as voraciously as possible in good habitats in order to put on as much body fat as possible. Body fat is actually the currency of migration. And they have to be able to find appropriate levels of the right kinds of food in order to top their tank, as it were, to enable and sustain those journeys. So when they land, where they land and the habitats that are available or not have a huge impact on their survival as they're moving across continents.
So somebody might say, well, okay, we lost some birds, but what would happen to Wisconsin's ecosystem, and I'm sure you've done some thinking and others have, if its migratory bird population significantly decreased, what would happen?
Well, there are a number of things that would probably fall into the category of cascading effects. And so first and foremost, birds are incredibly important environmental barometers. They're really reflective of what's going on in the environment. And when we start losing a large number of birds, it suggests something is awry and we need to pay attention. And so we lose that environmental monitoring capability as we lose birds. In addition, birds are incredibly important for environmental regulation. They eat lots of insects, and those insects are oftentimes pest insects associated with agriculture or just with, you know, with us in our neighborhoods. So if we lose birds' ability to consume vast quantities of insects every year, that spells trouble for us in terms of perhaps more rampant diseases, perhaps higher numbers of crop losses, and so on. Birds are also incredibly important for pollinating flowers and for dispersing seeds. And so all of these fundamental ecosystem services that they provide all would be called into question as bird numbers diminish. You know, is it really possible for us to sustain healthy ecosystems? And I think that there's great concern about that, and the jury is still very much out on that topic.
Yeah. How many of North America's birds head to Latin America for the winter?
So what we see, there are about 750 or so breeding species of birds in North America, and slightly more than half of those spend the winter in Latin America. And so if we look at birds we can place them in three general categories. There are resident species, particularly in Wisconsin, that are either tough enough, some would suggest foolish enough, to stay all winter. Those are the black-capped chickadees, many of our woodpeckers, crows, and so on, really tough birds that can survive the vicissitudes of a tough winter. Then there is a category of birds that are known as short-distance migrants. Those are typically the robins, the brown thrashers, the eastern phoebes, many of our sparrows that go to the southern United States. You know, it's not quite as hazardous if you don't have to go quite as far.
Yeah.
So they just want to escape warm weather. But fully half of our birds go all the way to Central and South America every winter and undertake these remarkable, actually miraculous journeys to reach their wintering habitats in Costa Rica and Panama and points south of there.
Amazing. And I just saw a news item today that the DNR has some partner action to save one disappearing songbird, which is the Connecticut warbler. I'm not sure if you probably know about the efforts to improve habitat in Bayfield County, of all places, and also in South America.
Yeah, so we're very concerned about Connecticut warblers, Larry, and I appreciate you bringing it up. This is a species that's in very steep decline. Wisconsin has lost 80% of its Connecticut warblers in just the last 20 years, range-wide, and most of the 97% of the continental population actually breeds in Canada. The entire continental population is down 60%. Now, this is a secretive species. It's a ground-dwelling warbler that's very rarely seen, and in fact, it's prized by birders because it's so seldom seen. And it breeds in largely inaccessible habitats. So this is a species that inhabits black spruce and tamarack bogs across Canada, northern Minnesota, northern Michigan, and just barely into Wisconsin. And what we're seeing is that despite the fact that these habitats are generally intact, this bird is still in a free fall population-wise. And so what we think is going on, Larry, is there's something going on in the wintering grounds where this bird spends the winter that's changing land use, and we suspect that rampant habitat loss in an area called the Gran Chaco. Now, the Gran Chaco is the second largest biome, the second largest biological area south of the Amazon in Central America. So the Amazon's the biggest forest. The Gran Chaco is the second largest forest in Central America. It's a drier type of forest than the Amazon, and as such, it's conducive to agriculture, and there are some profound transformations underway there. We're losing about 1 million acres of Gran Chaco a year. That's where, it seems, most of our Connecticut spend the winter. That's where all of our yellow-billed cuckoos spend the winter. That's where all of North America's Mississippi kites spend the winter, most of our nighthawks, and so on. And so you start to get a feel for how important these wintering habitats are. As they're lost, it's having an enormous impact on birds' ability to survive. So the Connecticut warbler is still a mystery. we're rapidly trying to tease out exactly what's going on in the breeding grounds and the wintering grounds, but we think it's a combination of things at both ends of its hemispheric range.
And so there's some action, partner action to try and resolve that.
Yeah, so there are, there are only three breeding pair of Connecticut warblers left in northwest Wisconsin, and we have a number of biologists, Ryan Brady and Rich Stafen and Nick Anich, all of whom are crack ornithologists that are working with Bayfield County to do habitat improvements around the area where those three breeding birds have been found in order to try to create more habitat and hopefully enable more species to breed successfully. At the same time, I'm working with, and several of us are working with, international partners that have a presence down in Bolivia and Paraguay and northern Argentina and the Gran Chaco to try to get things going down there as well.
And we could talk some more about that, but certainly we'll more broadly talk about efforts and work to conserve stopover points for birds here in the state with our guest Craig Thompson. He'll be back and with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the Wisconsin DNR's efforts to preserve stopover points for migratory birds. And our guest back with us, Craig Thompson, Chief of Program Integration in the Bureau of Heritage Conservation at our Wisconsin DNR. He leads the DNR's bird conservation efforts. So as we talk with Craig, I hope you'll join in. How are you helping migratory birds? Have you questions about them? Have you noticed a change in the numbers of migratory birds flying over your home this fall? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Craig, I think it'd be worth it maybe to talk a bit more about stopover habitat and more broadly.
So, Larry, what happens is birds respond to changes in photoperiod, and that's what brings, so as days lengthen in spring and daylight becomes shorter in fall, those changes in photoperiod trigger hormonal responses in birds, and they come into a condition that's known as Zugenruhe. Zugenruhe is a German term that means migratory restlessness, and I suspect it was coined by the same people that gave us Farfeknugen and Zeitgeist. And so what happens is migratory restlessness, these birds begin to drift around. They head to, for instance, in the case of Connecticut warblers and blackpoll warblers, a species that breeds across boreal Canada, they head to the East Coast where they begin to kind of stack up. So they begin to accumulate numbers. They feed voraciously. It's a condition that's known as hyperphagy. And so they feed voraciously in order to add as much body fat as possible. Because, again, that body fat is what enables them to fuel their long-distance migrations. And then when weather conditions are right, Connecticut warblers and blackpoll warblers are airborne. So they fly out over the Atlantic Ocean and then arc to the southwest and begin to fly to South America. Connecticut warblers fly for 48 hours nonstop. No breaks for food, no breaks for water,
amazing.
Until they land in Haiti to refuel, and then they fly again to South America. The situation with blackpolls is even more extreme, where they have been documented flying for 72 hours nonstop. Now, Larry, that's equivalent to one of us doing jumping jacks for 3 days straight with no breaks for food or water. It's just... it is physiologically taxing for these birds, and when they land, they're often emaciated, dehydrated, and they're not in great condition. And so as it relates to stopover site ecology, they need to stop over and refuel and rest and spend some time replenishing their body fat at sites that are considered to be critically important for them. If those sites disappear, we really start to look at the possibility of migration unraveling. So what we're doing is working with partners both in the United States and in Latin America to identify these critically important stopover sites so we can literally sustain migration of birds long term.
Wow, that's amazing. 48 hours, 72 hours, But when you land, after 72 hours, you got to get something to eat and drink.
You're pooped. And yeah, and if you land in a parking lot, that's not a good situation. And that does happen. And in fact, some of these birds are so exhausted during their journeys that there are anecdotal stories of freighters out in the Gulf of Mexico that overnight suddenly have huge fallouts of birds. And I've seen photos of multiple species of warblers and flycatchers sitting on the railings of freighters in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico at night because these birds are so pooped, they just need somewhere to sit and rest for a while. And so it's critically important then that we save those, that we identify those important stopover sites, those areas that allow birds to rest and refuel safely so they can continue their migratory journeys north in the spring and south in the fall. And we're in the process of working with South American and Central American partners to identify and protect those areas.
Yeah, I know there's been some land purchases and...
There has been some really great stuff going on in the world of conservation. I mentioned earlier to you, Larry, that one of the most significant being the purchase of 236,000 acres of forest in Belize. It was either purchase and protect this forest or watch the forest fall to industrial agriculture. Mm-hmm. There was a consortium of environmental organizations that came together, led by the Bobolink Foundation, that helped raise the funds and contribute funding to actually protect this enormous block of land, which is vitally important for our Kentucky warblers and our wood thrushes and our summer tanagers and so on. And so those kinds of actions are going to have long-term a very beneficial impact on migratory birds. We just have to accelerate our efforts in order to ensure that the most important sites are protected over the next decade.
Michael, who's near Wisconsin Dells, has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. Yeah, I have a question about birds hitting windows. We have a feeder, and we have quite a variety of birds that pass through our area of Bear Valley, Wisconsin, and inevitably we end up with birds hitting windows. And this year it seemed like we had a lot more birds than usual. We have the reflective tape, and we've tried other techniques, but they seem to hit the windows anyway. I was wondering if you had any suggestions. Thank you.
Yeah, Michael, I appreciate your concern. Thank you. What we know is that birds hitting windows is likely the second largest cause of bird mortality in North America, with upwards of perhaps a billion birds a year striking and dying on windows. And thankfully, it's something that we can address. And so I would suggest, if the reflective tape is not working for you, my wife, Mary, and I live on just north of La Crosse on the west coast, as it were. And what we've done are two different things. So you can go to a website that's called Acopian Bird Savers. You can simply Google that, A-C-O-P-I-A-N, Acopian Bird Savers, and look at what are called Zen window curtains, which are very easy to fashion from paracord. I've put them on all of our windows. We also had many, many window strikes, most of which were fatal. This is as we moved into the house, and now our window strikes are down to about zero. So it's been almost 100% effective. The other thing I know that can be effective is a white magic marker for particularly bad windows. You can actually stripe your window with a white magic marker that you can write on glass. And if you put a thin white stripe about 3 inches apart across the window, that seems to be very effective for breaking up that reflective surface and deterring birds from actually hitting the window. So a couple of other strategies you can try in order to try to minimize the amount of bird mortality associated with your bird feeding activities. And I really appreciate your interest in that. Thank you.
Yeah. Ross emailed a question. He's wondering about white whippoorwills in the state. It seems their numbers are declining, but he doesn't know if it's habitat here in Wisconsin or habitat in their wintering grounds.
Great question. It's probably all of the above. It's not just the loss of habitat. So whippoorwills are typically associated with more open forests, and our forests are becoming more brushy and occluded. A lot of non-native species are taking over the understory. That's not good for whippoorwills that want to fly around in those open forests and above them. And so there's habitat loss. It's a bird that breeds on the ground, so they're highly susceptible to high densities of nest predators like raccoons and skunks and possums. And they're also considered an aerial insectivore. And what that means is after nightfall, after sunset, these birds are aloft and they're seeking flying insects. That is their primary diet, and particularly medium to large size moths. Of course, there has been a significant decline in insect biomass over the last 20 years, and what we think is that that loss of insects across North America is having a profound impact on all of our aerial insectivores, our swifts, our swallows, our nighthawks, our whippoorwills, and so there just isn't enough food out there to sustain populations. And then to add insult to injury, there are things going on in the wintering grounds that are not good for any of those species in regard to habitat loss. So again, it's the double barrel, things happening on the breeding grounds and things happening on the wintering grounds as well, and we're trying to get a handle on it.
Yeah, Michael, thank you so much. Dennis in Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, I was wondering, because it's subject to come up before as far as replacing wetlands with, I guess you could call manufactured wetlands, do the migratory birds find them by odors, so maybe they would still find them as they migrate through, or do they just not find those at all? And as far as birds flying for 48 to 72 hours, I wonder, do they need some union representation?
So in answer to your first question, newly created wetlands, birds are very highly mobile. They're very good at finding new habitats. Now, most birds do not have a sense of smell, and with the exception being the vultures, many species of which have a very keen sense of smell. That's how they find those carcasses that are rotting out, that are out and about and rotting underneath the forest canopy. But most birds do not have a good sense of smell, and so they rely on visual cues. And it's, you know, and they also keep track of birds. So when birds are flying around, they watch what other birds are doing. So if one bird finds the wetland, then more will find it. So hopefully what's happened is that those are well-designed wetlands that will provide high-quality habitat. And then in regard to migratory birds and union representation, without a doubt, right, they would all be better off if they could take a rest when they needed to. But my gosh, they're just they're little feathered miracles, and they keep making these astronomical journeys every year. I have to share a little secret with you guys. Every spring when I'm out and about, if I see a scarlet tanager or a rose-breasted grosbeak or an eastern wood peewee, I lean forward and whisper, "Welcome back." I can't imagine what you endured to come all the way back from South America to Wisconsin, and I can't imagine what you must have witnessed on your way. It's truly a miracle that these birds can move across continents and twice yearly.
Oh, absolutely. Rory emailed us. They found a Harris's sparrow in their yard in Chippewa Falls this morning. It's still hanging around.
Wow, that is a great bird, Rory. Good for you. I think that's really wonderful. And it's a sparrow that shows up on occasion in Wisconsin. It's Canada's, to the best of my knowledge, it's Canada's only endemic breeding bird. So it's a Canadian breeder that winters in the central and southern plains of the United States. But once in a while, you get a bird with a bad gyroscope, and it flies a little bit off course, and those birds end up in Wisconsin. And we have the joy of experiencing them at our feeders. They're a large and a very lovely sparrow and a wonderful sighting, so good for you.
Yeah, good for you, Rory. And thanks for sharing it with us as well. Appreciate it. You could join in too, 800-642-1234. Scott in New Glarus, your turn now. Hi, Scott.
Yes, thank you. I'm very interested in preserving wetlands and doing everything we can to increase bird populations and habitat. In determining who or what party I might vote for, can you give me some guidance on who or what party you think might be more conducive to protecting wetlands and habitat and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, I'm just not in a position to be advocating for one party over another, Scott, but I really appreciate your comment in regard to being supportive of providing habitat for birds. I think the best thing you can do is just, you know, look at the candidates' platforms and decide for yourself who you think the best candidate will be in that regard. But I do appreciate your strong interest, and you know, we need more of your ilk that have that interest and are willing to take action on behalf of conservation and particularly on behalf of our beleaguered birds. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. JT emailed us a comment. They've had good success with bird curtains on their deck windows where they have their bird feeders. They made the curtains themselves using instructions on the Acopian Bird Saver website. A few angle irons and a roll of parachute cord is about all you need.
It's a really homespun operation to make window curtains, and they are crazy effective. And JT, thank you for doing that. And I'm really happy to hear that you've had success deterring bird collisions. And, you know, I've always thought, Larry, if we could get everybody to do at least try their worst window. So virtually all of us have, all of us that live in homes or even apartments have a window collision issue. That's just the nature of the situation. And typically some windows are worse than others. And so if people would be willing to give just one window a try, put a Zen curtain over that window. And, you know, I know one of the big things is, oh my gosh, is it going to affect how the house looks and will I be able to see through it? Two responses to that. We did Zen window curtains on our entire home, and when we had friends drive up shortly after they were installed, they said, oh my gosh, did an architect design that for you? So we said, okay, that's taken care of. So that was a wonderful response. And then in terms of looking out, you just really, they're just, you know, black cords, thin black cords that dangle out on the outside of the windows, and you just look right through them. It gets to a point where you don't even see them anymore. And my gosh, they are so effective at deterring bird collisions. So thanks, JT, for that compelling story of success on your end.
Yeah. And you're not the only person who's told me that after a time, you don't even notice they're there.
Right.
Yeah, it goes away. Kathy in Northwoods, Fifield, let's go to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. We also had problems with birds hitting our very wide windows. We ended up getting vertical blinds. They're about 3 inches, you know, across, and you can pretty much see very well, you know, through them, but those vertical lines, when they're open, it has deterred the birds from hitting the windows.
Wow.
That's really wonderful to hear, and I appreciate yet another testimonial about how window collisions are being addressed. And interesting, your blinds are spaced at exactly the right distance, which is about 3 inches. It turns out if, for instance, the cords or blinds were 5 or 6 inches apart, birds are inclined to try to navigate that space between them. And so through the process of trial and error, the folks who designed these sorts of things that are considered to be effective window treatments for birds determined that three plus inches is the ideal interval in order to dissuade birds from flying through that. They simply look and go, well, I can't make it through that, so they don't try.
Jeremy emailed us a question. He wonders, does the shifting of the magnetic poles affect bird migration?
That's a great question, Jeremy, for which I do not have a response. What we think is that birds use a number of cues, some visual, particularly the orientation of sun and stars, in order to migrate successfully every year. There is also indication that birds use magnetic fields to migrate. A lot of species have an element called magnetite in their head, and we believe they're able to sense magnetic fields and orient appropriately as they're migrating both north and south. To the extent that you have shifting poles, I don't know how that may or may not influence it, but perhaps another question that needs to be explored and investigated in order to fully understand what makes birds tick.
What could you talk more? Someone mentions about the Neotropical Flyways Project.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad you brought that up, Larry. Thank you. So there is a group that Wisconsin DNR and the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, our philanthropic partner, we're working with down in Columbia. It's an organization called SELVA, S-E-L-V-A, and they do conservation research. And they have a strong migratory bird program. And SELVA is led by a wonderful their migratory bird program is led by a wonderful biologist by the name of Dr. Nick Bailey. And Nick has crews out in Belize, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama, and Colombia, identifying those critical sites that are oh so important for bird migration. And we are finding amazing things. So one example, there's an arid peninsula that sticks out into the Caribbean Sea on the northern coast of Colombia. It's called the Guajira Peninsula. And it turns out the Guajira Peninsula is critically important, a stopover site for yellow-billed cuckoos and for black pole warblers, both in spring and fall migration. And so as a result, we're now working with Selva is working with ranchers to plant the kinds of trees that provide the caterpillars in pastures that those birds need to fuel their migrations. And the ranchers are very receptive to it because it provides shade for their cattle and some forage for their cattle as well. So it's an instance where, as they're identifying these critically important stopover sites across Latin America, they're simultaneously working to engage locals to ensure those sites are protected and well managed in order to help sustain bird migration. It is a wonderful project.
And one that I don't think we've mentioned that I find interesting is the Southwest Wisconsin, and you know, back here in the state, the Grasslands Network. Are you familiar? You're familiar with that, I'm sure.
I am. It's rebranded now as the Southern Driftless Grasslands, and it is an excellent example of bringing conservation to scale. And what I mean by that is, what we've traditionally done conservation-wise is work at specific sites, so in a state park, at a wildlife area, say at Rush Creek State Natural Area, and we're very good at site-based conservation. Where we have a lot to learn and where we're trying to scale up is working across entire landscapes, not just at a single site. And Southern Driftless Grasslands is a great example of a multifaceted collaborative with a number of partners that are all coming together to work on the last great former prairie landscape in Wisconsin that still has not only prairie remnants but a great deal of grass and is vitally important for our grassland birds. And by the way, Larry, grassland birds have declined more precipitously than almost any other group of birds in North America. So what they're doing down there is trying to keep grass in the ground, trying to work with local farmers to make sure that agricultural practices are compatible with conservation, and doing all sorts of great things and making terrific progress. So that is a wonderful example of a partnership that has an expansive, effective reach across an entire landscape.
And finally, here in the last 45 seconds or so, we talked about blinds and stopping birds from hitting our windows, but what else could we do?
So Plant native species, that is our mantra. The birds are entirely reliant on fuel to migrate and to breed, for that matter. And if you have native species in your yard, native trees, shrubs, and forbs, it's going to provide the insects and the fruit that they need to endure, to successfully raise young and then to be able to successfully migrate every year. And so what we found is 70% of the vegetation in any given yard should be native, and then those are considered really productive habitats. If you go below 70% native vegetation, the birds have a harder time finding enough food to sustain themselves.
And join me in keeping your cats indoors.
Yes, and thank you, Larry. Please keep your cats indoors. Kitty cats are wonderful animals. They are incredibly efficient predators, and they are the number three cause of bird mortality in North America. So keeping your cats indoors is going to help enormously.
Craig, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Larry. My pleasure to join you today.
Craig Thompson, Chief of Program Integration in the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation with our Wisconsin DNR. He'll be back. We'll do it again with him. Tomorrow, a time to talk about home improvement, and we'll learn how to keep the cold air out and the warm air in. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.